I had a phone call from Tim O'Brien, and Tim is on the phone right now. How are you doing, Tim?
Steve, I'm doing great. I'm driving across the state of Wisconsin, getting ready to play some music later tonight with Daryl Scott.
Well, and that's what made me think that I ought to get you on. Now, I know you just left Raleigh and the whole big IBMA celebration there, and then I also saw that you had this new album with Daryl, which I played several cuts from the last couple of weeks. It's a great album as normal. And tell me a little bit about this. The album is called what? Memories and Moments.
Yeah, Daryl and I made a record 13 years ago called Real Time, and that was just meant to be just something to represent what we were starting to do on the road. We had been playing about a year, and had written songs together, and we had recorded together on each other's records. But this was a new step, and we didn't really think that much of it. And then we kept playing together for another 2.5 years, but then we kind of went off and did our different things, and now we're back together. It's really a great thing. He's such a powerful musician, and such a real big, solid presence. You know, like a big old oak tree of music. He's got, you can just kind of lean against it. You know, and oh, it's great.
You, of course, I'll just get old school on you here, Tim. I go back to wow, there's Hot Rise, and let's go see Hot Rise. Let's buy Hot Rise records, which back in the day, as now we say, even though it was, you know, back in the 70s, today it's back in the day for me, and I've been a fan of yours since those days, and the sound there was just, I mean, you guys came out of nowhere, and I still say this, and you don't have to respond to this necessarily unless you want to. I think Hot Rise was maybe the most, I'll say, articulate band, I think, of all those members up and down the row that you could sit and discuss. Like, we just had this brilliant conversation with Paul Brock about Irish music, which was wonderful. And I know Pete Wernick, I've been a fan of yours. I've not had a chance to chat with you, but I think that Hot Rise band may have been, as a group, the most articulate. It's the only word I can use to describe that band as a whole. And the music was wonderful, but I mean, the individuals were just, look at what you're doing today still.
Well, geez, Steve, thanks a million. That was a good period of time. You know, each sort of, you can measure them in decades, or, you know, you can call them eras. It's just, you know, as people get, they come of age, they learn their craft or their art or whatever it is, and then you find a way in, and everything's developing. I mean, that was kind of like through the 80s. We started in 78, the Hot Rise, and then through the 80s, and we kind of stopped being full-time in 1990, but it was a time when, you know, you had the sort of new grass, progressive explosion. Not only the new grass revival, but David Grisman was just kind of coming through with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a thing with National Bluegrass Band and Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver and Hot Rise, Johnson Mountain Boys, kind of a step back into more of a, I don't know, just a more purely bluegrass approach, just kind of trying to keep the center solid, you know, and both in the way you played it, also the way you presented it, and
right,
people wearing suits, ties. You know, we were part of that, and but we also had our own little place within that little press. It was a very good time for me. I was like, apprenticeship, really. I had been playing music professionally, but this was a new step. This was national, and it was a great, great time.
It was fun. It was a fun band and a good band, and I still remember those days fondly. And of course, you've done so many things since then. You've been on your own, you've been with Molly, you've done these things with Daryl, I saw you at Gray Fox with, every time I looked up there was Tim O'Brien with another band behind him, and they were following you. You had a band, I remember Noam Pikilny was in that set, I don't know if it's Friday or Saturday night, and pretty much, you know, straight ahead bluegrass stuff. I also see you with, don't you show up with the Earls of Leicester, is that how you say it?
Yeah, I was in the Earls of Leicester at Gray Fox as well. That's a great thing. We got to play together at the IBMA Awards show, kind of honoring our fiddle player's father, Paul Warren, the great fiddler, who who was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Jerry's idea was to get this thing together and play Flat Scruggs music, and of course, Johnny Warren playing his dad's fiddle stuff is just really the icing on the cake there. It was really fun to play with those guys.
That was a great show. I actually leapt out of my booth and ran around to the fence, to the front of the stage, as soon as I heard Charlie kick off the first Flat and Scruggs. And Jerry Douglas comes on and introduces it. You know, we're going to play it note for note. We're not going to be up here jamming. We're doing Flat and Scruggs, you know, as much as we can recreate that sound and feeling. And that's another great thing that you're involved in. And the thing with Daryl Scott now is just... you guys work together so well, and I always want to talk to people about how do you do that? How do you find people that you kind of meld with so well? And maybe you were talking about that, and I interrupted you. You were talking about him being such a big figure in music and something to lean on, but obviously you get along with him really well, or you wouldn't be able to travel and record like this.
Well, Daryl's music is like I said, it's incredibly strong. He can lead a thing and you know exactly where it's going. He just steers and you know, and then you can play with that, and then he responds to you explosively sometimes, and it's just it's exciting. And then he I'm leading the song and he does the same. We kind of come from the same direction that way. It's also true that neither of us really is concerned with recreating the way we played it the last time. It kind of can go any which way after a while. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we kind of look for some of that. And so in that regard, it's like inside out of what the Earls of Leicester are doing. I mean, all of these things are different manifestations or, you know, a point on the compass. If there's 360 degrees, in a circle, you know, there's at least that many angles of viewing music and figuring it out and going at it, you know, and you learn more about it as you try those different angles.
When you show up with, when people go see Daryl and you on stage, how many do you travel with a large band? Is it you and Daryl? I've seen you before, Tim, where it's just Tim O'Brien, which is wonderful, but I mean, do you do this as two guys? Do you have a band with you?
No, we're playing solo company as a duet. Mm-hmm. We've got four instruments. Is that right? We've got five instruments on the stage, and we share them. Banjo, guitar, kazuchi between the two of us. And, well, Daryl might play the mandolin here and there, too. And then I play the fiddle, too. We bring that stuff, and it's great now. We've got this record out, and we actually have a really good tour set up and good support group. A good sound man, and we're ready to make this thing go. It's just starting now. We just played our first gigs this last weekend.
Now, you're going to be down in one of my favorite venues and one of my favorite show places in Lexington. You're going to be down at Woodsong's Old Time Radio Hour on the 21st of October, I think, if I have that date right. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be down there. I haven't been back for Michael's thing in a good while. It'll be good to see him again. The night before that, we're doing Mountain Stage. We're taping a Mountain Stage, so we'll get our radio show going and repeat it there.
And Michael Jonathan's been on this show before, and he's going to actually come on next Saturday and give away some tickets to your show down there with Daryl. And I think on the same, that same show is Sierra Hull and Ron Block. Maybe, is that correct?
I don't know. That sounds great.
I think that's correct. I'm just going to tell you, I believe that's accurate. So Michael will be on next week to talk about you coming down there. And do you have a website where people can follow you? Is the album available on the website? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a website. It's timanddaryl.com. Daryl, in this case, spelled so many ways. D-A-R-R-E-L-L. But yeah, timanddaryl.com, you can find out the dates. You can see them on Daryl's website or my website as well, but... Yeah, we'll be around. We're getting a good bit. We've got a good full schedule through the middle of November, and we take a little break. We start again in the middle of January and go, and it's looking good.
You mentioned this is just odd coincidence after talking to Paul Brock about Irish music and the influence, and you mentioned the bouzouki. Now, I mean, I've seen you play that. I kind of know what it is, but maybe to this audience, can you explain to them why Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott show up with a bouzouki and what it relates to as far as the normal kind of a bluegrass setup? I know you're not playing it in a bluegrass setting here, but tell them what the bouzouki is.
Well, bouzouki is from the family of stringed instruments that has pairs of strings, like the mandolin. Tamburitsas, you know, tamburas, they're kind of Balkan version of that. Balalaika is a Russian one. But yeah, the bouzouki is kind of like the mandolin. It's a Greek cousin to the Italian mandolin. And then, but the Irish players in maybe, I'm not sure who the first, when the first one was, maybe in the late 60s, some of them like Donald Lunny and Andy Irvine, they started playing these things and tuning them an octave below the fiddle, which is the same role, it's sort of the same range as a tenor banjo takes most of the time in Irish music. But this is more of an accompanying instrument. It's more of a strumming thing. And so I used to see guys playing those things, and I just love the sound of them. And when the Flatiron Company started making them, I've got one. You know, it's sort of hard to find in the United States. They're more like the Irish version of a bouzouki. They got the same setup, but they're a Greek bouzouki usually has a big bowl back, like a bowl back Italian mandolin.
Right.
These are flat back usually, or arched back or something. Much easier to hold, and they're just slightly different sound. They work really good in this kind of music. And then So in bluegrass, it gives it a Celtic flavor, but it also just, it's just another voice. I'm always looking for a slightly different spice if I need it, you know.
Hold on one second. That's not supposed to be happening. Here is something I've never quite understood. It's clearly a Greek instrument, even the sound, but why did it get so embedded in Ireland? Have you ever researched that? I know you go to Ireland and obviously you play Irish music and are influenced by it, but...
Well, it's like, I think Andy Irvine went to the Balkans, and he was into Bulgarian and Balkan music. Anyway, I think maybe, I'm not sure how that all that's happened, but I think he came back to Ireland with a bouzouki, and he started writing tunes on it and singing, you know, writing tunes that he would sing and using it as the accompanying instrument. And he had already played mandolin and guitar, so he's using it kind of like a thing that's in between the two. And then it just became popular, and then they started making them specifically for those players. And it's a nasal kind of sounding thing, like a mandolin, lower pitch than a mandolin. And it's really good for drones, like, in Irish music, there might be one chord for the first two times through a tune, you know, and they just play one chord like a bagpipe does, just one note underneath. So they get a whole bunch of sort of drone, you know, things going together, and the bouzouki sounds great doing that. And so it's kind of like a banjo has a drone like that.
Right.
So it's just a different way of expressing a similar kind of tonality.
The player that I've seen really, really dig it, and there's lots of great players, and I've just only been fortunate to see Roger Landis play one, and he just can really, he really digs into a bouzouki. Then when I went up to talk to him after the show, the strings were like, you know, a mile high, and how you get, I don't know how your thing is set up, but the fact that you can even get your fingers to the frets on at least the way Roger Landis, who, like I said, is the one person I can tell for certain I've seen play up close. Yeah, it's kind of like a big mandolin, but jeepers though. Are your strings that high? I mean, I know you don't know what I'm talking about, but I mean, are they really, really high? I mean, do you get more volume doing that? I'm curious about the instrument, I guess.
Well, the instrument I got a pretty good amount of volume as is, and I plug it in usually, so I kind of lower the action down, although
okay.
I know the thing with the high action is good if you're, like Roger plays that. That's his instrument.
Right.
I kind of go back and forth through so many things. I'll make excuses here for not having high action. I mean, you really need to be up on it, on your technique to use the high action. But it makes the instrument sound good. And my action's, I think, in general, higher than most sort of folkies would do, but it's not maybe as high as Roger's. I don't know. I don't know what Roger's like. They're a little bit of a bear to play at bouzouki. So, you know, like, there's a lot of tension on those strings sometimes.
Well, I mean, it's not that you're not, you know, playing high action because you're not capable. I'm just was curious about the sound that you're trying to create, and I think you've answered that pretty darn well. Let's talk again a little bit about this new album. I played a couple tunes already last week and this week as we were getting ready for today. Are there, and you recorded Paradise with John Prine, which must have been pretty cool.
That was really cool. It's just really cool in so many ways. it's such an honor, first of all, to be beside the guy, as you know, on the same, you know, same floor with him, singing and playing. And he's just one of the great American treasures. What an amazing poet, and just such a natural one. And then, of course, you're blown away that he would even consider doing it. So, and then the third thing, which we were going to invite a whole bunch of people to guest on this record. You know, we're thinking there's a bunch of people we played with in the past that would be kind of cool to sort of fit them in. And we had a long list, and some of them had been contacted, but John Prine had already been arranged and a date had been set. And then we did our sessions for most for the rest of the record, and it all happened so fast, and it came out so well. We went, well, gee, the record's done. We don't really need any of this other stuff, but we got John Prine who wants to do this, and we should do, still do that. And it happened to dovetail nicely with one of the songs that we had written. The only song we written specifically for the record was about mountaintop removal. It's called Keep Your Dirty Lights On.
Yeah.
So we had that song, and then we had we knew we were going to record Paradise, which is about strip mining. You know,
kind of fits.
And kind of go together, and it was really cool that we got to do that.
Did you go to see him? Did he come to see you? I mean, did you do it in Nashville? I don't remember where
we
this
live
thing
in,
was recorded.
We all live in Nashville.
Okay.
I recorded a studio that most of the time I recorded at the studio that is co-owned by John and David Ferguson. And so we just picked the time, and Fergie was there. We set up some mics, and we sat around the circle and played this thing.
You know, I did. Bob
just happened to be coming by. I said, if you're coming by and you can bring your bass, we might have a session for you.
There you go.
So that just happened, and it was just very off the cuff. It was mostly started out, John got there, and we talked about stuff, just off the cuff about a lot of stuff for about an hour before the guitars ever came out. And then we got it together to play, and it happened real fast.
You know, there's something, and I've lived in Kentucky my whole life, and I didn't realize how literal Paradise was until I was driving in Western Kentucky, and all the names that he talks about, he's not making up, as you know, this is the Garden of Eden, paradise has been ruined. There's a little town called Paradise right over the same river. It's like a roadmap.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just perfect. And I think his writing, John Prine is simple but brilliant. I mean, he will write a song, and once you see the signs on the road as you're heading to that part of the state, you realize he's writing about what he saw and what he recognized was happening, but his songs seem to be so literal, but yet so have much more. I think he tries to keep it simple, but says so much. So it must have been a blast just sitting around hanging around with him for an hour.
Yes, it is simple and somehow really
profound. You were going to say
so
profound.
Much information in that simple presentation and you know, arrangement of words and music. It's just, I don't know. It's mysterious, isn't it?
Yeah.
he placed names and all in there. You know, one of the things we talked about was the Monroe Brothers, and because and Arnold Schultz. You know, Arnold Schultz was from, he was the guy that Bill Monroe learned from. He learned from his uncle Penn, but also from Arnold Schultz, who was an itinerant black musician who played the guitar and the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Mose Rager, who ended up teaching the Everly, Mike Everly and Merle Travis.
Right.
So in this one black man that kind of frequented that little area of the country, Muhlenberg County and Ohio County, Kentucky, right across the river from one another, he kind of put a major dose of his musical style into country music. Anyway, John was talking about the Monroe Brothers. My aunt used to see them come around, and she said she thought they were gangsters. They dressed up in these really nice suits, and no one else was. And they would come back to town, and they'd have these big long cars. She said we thought they might have been gangsters.
Gangsters. Well, you know what? On the right time, on the right day, they might have, could have been, depending on what you were talking about.
Well, it's just, you know, they were so they were from there and they come back, but, you know, they were such big stars. I mean, they were like movie stars or gangsters to them. You know, they were like really flamboyant. Something, you know, they didn't see around there.
And then that whole stretch, I mean, of course, there's a parkway now that connects them all, but in that whole little stretch of Kentucky, you've got the Everly Brothers, you've got the Monroe Brothers, you've got Merle Travis and John Prine. I mean, it's kind of a neat, and what you're talking about now is all that kind of certainly touches on the gentleman that you were mentioning, and it's so much, and geez, think of what Merle Travis has contributed to just guitar playing alone.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, really.
That's cool.
Nobody knows much about Arnold Schultz, except that he worked on the railroad in the summers up there. He would spend the winters in New Orleans, and I don't know anybody that knows anything about him in New Orleans. Bell and Rowe apparently loved his bass runs on the guitar. He really liked what he did with the bass runs. Mm. And I think he must have played with his thumb mostly, you know, thumb and fingers, because that's how Moe's Rigger. I mean, that's where Merle Travis, Ike Everly, that's what they do.
Right. Isn't that wild how you can trace so much back to, like, one guy traveling through an area and just kind of everybody else is sort of absorbing it?
Yeah. I don't think there's any known picture of the guy.
Really? You know what? When you said that, I was thinking, when we get off here today, I'm going to Google just to see if there are any images with so many things up there. But I've never seen one, but I'm going to find out in about half an hour. I'll double check in about half an hour and see what's out there for him.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right. Well, listen, are there any – I've played several tunes from the Memories and Moments album, and I love it all. You know, the show is unreal bluegrass for a number of reasons. I kind of stretched the boundaries out. I knew that was going to happen when I started doing this, so I left myself leeway to do that. Is there a tune that you would like for me to pick out of the list that I have here and play, or just anything, or does it matter to you?
Well, I like them all, Steve. I don't know. Lately I've been listening more closely to that one. I'm kind of relearning some of this stuff as we play our shows, but the one called On Life's Other Side. It's the closest thing out, and it's kind of a gospel-y thing. And yet, we were just this morning, after we had a gig last night on the Mississippi River in Winona, a little festival, wonderful, wonderful night. And then this morning, this guy had offered us a kayak trip, and we went out on the little back channel of the Mississippi. And that's kind of, you know, Life's Other Side, it sounds like we're singing about the afterlife, but really, I think we're talking more about how to enjoy your day, your life,
okay,
your year, and find paradise—the real, you know, the real joy.
Well,
right here and now.
You wanna stick around while I play that? I know you're on the road and you probably pulled over, but I'm happy to let you go now. If you want to stick around for a while, I'm open to whatever you want to do. But I definitely want to play that tune.
I think we're going to get back on the road in a minute, but,
okay,
but go ahead and spin that, and we'll see if the connection holds.
All right, good. All right, we'll do that. All right, hold on 1 second. I'm talking to Tim O'Brien. This is Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass, and you heard him. We're going to play from Memories and Moments, an album with Tim and Daryl Scott, and this is the tune he was just talking about, On Life's Other Side. It's really about a kayak ride. All right, cool. That was from Daryl Scott, Tim O'Brien's new album. That was the On Life's Other Side, and we're back with Tim. And Tim, I know you're heading out, and you're just starting to beat down the doors with this new album with Daryl Scott, and it's a great one. Thanks so much for stopping by today, and anything else you want to say about where you're going to be or what you're thinking about? I know you pulled over. I want you to get back on the road, but this has been a blast. I appreciate it so much.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. Quite a week for bluegrass with the IBMA and Tony Rice becoming a Hall of Fame member.
Yeah.
It's just, and I'm happy to be out here doing this. I really appreciate you promoting the music. I'm about to play at Stoughton, Wisconsin tonight, at Chicago tomorrow at the Old Town School. Encourage folks. Oh,
yeah.
I don't know what the air date is here, but we're going to be on Weekend Edition tomorrow morning, apparently.
Oh, good.
NPR listeners can check that out,
yeah,
or you can get off the archives sometime. But
okay.
Anyway, thanks for having me.
Hey, Tim, anytime you want to come back, man, I'm happy to chat and we'll talk about whatever comes up. I don't have a scripted thing. I just like to touch on different things that come up and just kind of go with it, you know?
It's great, man. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Tim. Take it easy. Have a good trip, and we'll catch up to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.